Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. I think it's safe to say that film fuels Jessica Thompson. The Australian-born writer, director, editor, and producer has been in the business for 20 years. She studied acting at three major drama schools in Australia and then attended film school for writing and directing at Sydney's University of Technology. It's there Jessica met Carlo Vallejo. They joined forces and made several short films together, including Hike, for which she won the prestigious Kodak Film Award for New Directors. Jessica spent 9 months crisscrossing the U.S., during which time she filmed the documentary series The Land of Milk and Honey. Her trip ended in New York, where she's lived since 2010, and where she co-founded Steadfast Productions, a collective of visual storytellers who use imagery to entertain, provoke thought, and explore the human condition. It's in New York that she wrote, directed, and edited the short film Across the Pond, which was selected as a finalist at three film festivals. She's worked as an editor with two-time Oscar-nominated filmmaker Liz Garbus, as an associate producer on the indie thriller 419 and Seeds of Time. She edited the documentary Back on Board, Greg Louganis, which aired on HBO in 2015. Jessica just made her feature writing and directing debut with the 2017 release of The Light of the Moon, which had its world premiere at the South by Southwest Film Festival and won the Audience Award for Best Narrative Feature. It tells the story of Bonnie, a young and successful Latina architect who was sexually assaulted walking home after spending the evening with friends at a bar in Brooklyn. In his review in Variety, Andrew Barker wrote, "The film is harrowingly effective in its streamlined, no-frills way, sensitive without ever being sanctimonious, brutally frank, without ever lapsing into exploitation." So let's meet this accomplished creative woman, Jessica. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, what an introduction. I hope I can live up to that.
Well, we'll see. Start back. Mm-hmm. What happened with you in film? What was the connection?
Yeah, I mean, it happened when I was 12. Actually, it was May the 5th, 1995.
But who remembers?
So I come from a family of migrants. My mum is Maltese, born on the tiny little island called Malta. My grandparents took her a four-month journey to Australia, and, you know, she was raised in a chicken shed for the first 5 years of her life. So just to say that I come from, you know, definitely not film stock. I come from blue-collar workers and very hard-working immigrant.
And they
family.
Wanted to leave life in Malta and make a better life in Australia?
Yeah. So my grandparents, they both lost people in World War II. My mum is named after my grandfather's brother, who was, they're not meant to bomb churches. That's kind of a rule in war, but I think the Germans bombed a church in Malta and killed my great uncle, who was only 9 at the time. And so my grandparents were children during the World War II, and they just, I think from those terrible memories.
And let's get out.
Yeah, they were like, let's get out. So they took this, you know, did not speak a word of English and took a four-month boat trip. The British government was paying what they called white Europeans. I don't know what that means really, but Italians, Greeks, Maltese, Lebanese, they were paying these people to come to Australia because Australia had been decimated as well. And our population was, you know, hardly anyone in such a big country. So my grandfather took the ticket, not telling my grandmother.
And oh, wow.
I think he thought it was a small little boat trip, but it wasn't. Anyway, this might be one of my films in one day. But,
and it took them 4 months.
4 months on a boat, yeah. And my grandmother was pregnant with my mom.
Oy, oy, oy.
So then they came to Australia. All that to say is that, you know, my mom spent the first 5 years of her life not speaking English, only speaking Maltese, because they grew up in like a very small part of Sydney, which was just Maltese people. You think that there's hardly any of us, but there's a lot of us in Australia.
Wow.
So all that to say is that there was no one in my family in the creative arts whatsoever. We were all very hardworking kind of tradesmen. And
to survive.
To
mean,
survive,
your goal
yeah.
was to survive.
Absolutely. And so then when I was 12.
Well, let me just back up. Did your mom marry your dad who was Maltese or no?
No. So my dad is Australian.
All right.
And he is still a bit of a troubled man. He's an addict. So he left the family when I'm the youngest of four.
Okay.
So that, again, my mum raised four children on her own, completely on her own. And he left, my dad left when I was maybe 3. So getting into the arts was definitely not maybe something that I should have been thinking about.
But did you see it maybe as an escape?
Yes, 100%. Storytelling to me has always been...
To transcend your reality,
absolutely.
Right?
I would wake up every night and I had a dream diary next to my bed, and I would write down all of my stories and I would tell them to my mom, and I'd write short stories. And I always had this urge to tell stories and to hear stories, to listen and write. And then when I was 12, we picked family movie night and it was Braveheart. Aside what maybe Mel Gibson has become, he was...
well, he is an Aussie.
I don't know if we claim him anymore, Sandy.
Right.
But I don't think he claims us either. But back then he was still pretty cool. And I watched it and I saw that he acted and directed in it. And I just turned around and I just said, that's what I'm going to do. I want to do that. And my mum, for such an amazing woman who had to deal with so much hardship in her life, she never said no to me. She wouldn't give me an overly enthusiastic yes.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
She said, if you show me you want to do this, then you can do it. So I went through the yellow pages back then before, you know, the internet. And I went through all the drama schools and I called them all and I asked them about their programs and asked them how much it was. And I said to my mum, one, will you let me go on a train for an hour on my own to get to Sydney City? We lived in the suburbs. And she was like, no. And so I was like...
And you were how old at that point?
12.
Well, yeah. That was the right answer.
Yeah, that was right.
As a mother?
Them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she let me go once I turned like 16. I started mm-hmm. to go to the ones in the city.
Did you have to be accepted?
Yes, you had to audition or you had to show writing samples and things like that.
But this was acting school.
This was acting and writing. It was like an overall drama academy.
Did you know at 16 or even at 12 what you wanted to do? Did you want to write or did you want to act?
I wanted to act, write, and direct.
Okay. All three. Okay.
Yeah. So then I found out there was one near us that was maybe a 30-minute drive and I couldn't get there via public transit. So I asked her you can imagine one mum with four kids. And my brother was an Olympian at the time. So
we're not going to be dismissive of that. What do you mean an Olympian?
He was an elite gymnast at the time training for the Sydney Olympics. So he was training 36 hours a week.
Oh,
so
my God.
My mom was just running around. And I was like, I'm putting more on her plate. But she saw how enthusiastic I was. And I said, at 14 and 9 months, I can start working and I will pay you back. And I did. I started working at Toys R Us.
Here's a determined young girl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that teenager. Was it. She never said no. She said, sure, if you've gone to this much effort, you must feel something about it. And so I started to go to acting and writing and drama school in general. But that was more geared towards stage. So directing stage plays and things like that. Yeah. And
started, were you talented when it came to the acting?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely...
And they encouraged you, your teachers?
Yeah, and I had an agent. I kind of was a child actor.
Okay, yeah. Then the answer is yes.
Yes. Though I think now in hindsight, and I still love acting and friends still ask me to, you know, be in their shorts and things like that, and I'm more than happy to. But I see it as a way, I think all of this was for me to gear up to being a great director, I hope, one
mm-hmm,
day.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, because I can speak to actors using their language. I understand what kind of tools they're using. Same with my editing of 10 years. I see that as my way of communicating to editors and commuting and understanding coverage and understanding things. You know, so I think all of these things only help a director in their tasks and put more tools in your toolbox type thing.
Was there something inside of you telling you to take the next step in terms of going to university?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you were getting roles and gigs, but that may not have been the most satisfying thing for you.
To be honest, what it was, and this is a lot in the news lately, I didn't like the judgment from being an actor. I was being measured, you know, as in physically, my body, by casting directors and things like that. And mm-hmm. I knew, even though I wasn't quite aware at the ages of 14, 15, 16, I was like, I don't think this is healthy. You know, I couldn't quite articulate,
mm-hmm.
but I knew I didn't like the feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't like being judged. I didn't like going into a room and seeing other girls like me, or because just like any other teenager, I'd struggle with, you know, acne or skin and feeling like I was constantly being judged. I was already judging myself. And then there's a room full of people, you know, criticizing me, telling me whether I should gain weight, lose weight, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, I just could tell at 15, this is not healthy. So I concentrated more on stage because I felt like they were not as
judgmental in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did a lot of stage work when I was young. So I kind of hung up my acting laurels when I was about 21.
Mm-hmm.
So I was still doing it during university, during undergrad. But I knew straight away, I mean, there was no other course that I would apply for except for this film course. And it was at UTS is one of the University of Technology Sydney. The way it works in Australia is quite different to the US because you can only get into a university based on your marks. You can't write letters. You can't pay anyone.
Gee, what a novel concept. In other words, you have to have the grades.
Yes. The only negative is, though, for art, more artistic endeavours, you still need to have extremely high grades because it's about the competition. It's about how many students want to do that course.
All right.
For instance, we had to get over 96% of all of it. I'm talking math, science, everything. And then there was another option to hand in a portfolio. So I was studying my ass off, basically.
No kidding.
And then, lo and behold, I didn't expect to get over the marks, but I did. And so
this has nothing to do with scholarship.
No, that
this
doesn't
is just,
exist.
Just scholarships don't exist.
It's so cheap in Australia to go to school.
Oh, there's a novel concept.
Yeah.
You mean it doesn't cost $60,000, $70,000 a year to...
$2,500 a semester. And a semester is 6 months. So it was like $5,000
All right, I can't react to this after putting two kids through college here,
so
but whatever, okay.
Everything relied on your grades.
I understand.
And because my mother was a single mom, I actually did get a stipend from the government to go to a very novel concept, which is also how my mother put herself through. She, after my dad left, my mother put herself back into high school. Because her parents had taken her out at 16, and she's an extremely smart woman. So she put herself back to high school and university and postgrad, all on a scheme to help single mothers elevate themselves out of...
Is she still in Australia?
Yes. She's a...
I have to Skype this woman.
She's incredible.
Sure,
she
sounds
hero.
It. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And she came over just last week for the world premiere of the film. So
oh, how wonderful.
It was wonderful.
So you get into school, and as I said in the introduction, you met Carlo Vallejo. Mm. I think you need to explain to us what the significance of that is. Who is he?
It's huge. He is my producing partner and my best friend. So we met on day one of film school. And like I said, you know, it was a hard school to get into. And I came in and I don't know what I was thinking. I had this idea that they were all going to be these really artistic kids, just like, and really off the beaten path. And I should preface that I had, I was going through my punk rock phase and I had my hair dyed a million colors and, you know, my skateboard under my arm and, like, you know, was in my very grunge alter phase. And I walked in and I thought all the kids are going to look like me. And then I realized that arts also breeds an air of wealth. So the kids that were there were more so what we call like the yuppies, or like they were more like the eastern suburbs kids in Australia, which basically means the more rich kids.
Were you intimidated?
I was completely intimidated. I knew that I was like...
Did you feel you were out of your league?
No, I felt like I knew that I had the talent and the
skill. You had the right to be there.
But I felt like, oh, this was not... They just looked so pristine and they looked so wealthy.
So
like,
who am I going to relate to here?
Yeah, so I quickly scanned the room. There's only 30 students who are accepted into this program. So I was like, oh gosh, they're all like blonde, blue-eyed beauties who surf every day and like things like that.
The
and
quintessential Aussie.
Aussie. And I was like, oh, that's not me. You know, I'm, you know...
Here's our token funky...
Yes, student. Alternative student. And then I scanned the room and I saw this beautiful Filipino boy, brown skin and big smile. And I thought, oh, I bet he lives where I'm from, which is where all the migrants kind of were in Australia, the western suburbs. And lo and behold, I was right. So I walked straight up to him and I said, hi, I'm Jess. And he said, I'm Carlo. And I said, where are you from? And he said, I live in Granville. And I said, I live in Parramatta. I said, you want to catch the train in the morning? And that was it.
So you were commuting students?
Yeah, the two of us were the only students that commuted from the western suburb. No one lives on campus in Australia. We all commute. But they would commute from the eastern suburbs, which is very short distance. And we had an hour and a half on the train every morning. So we would meet at the train station. We were the only two western suburbs kids. And we would develop this bond because we'd speak, you know, we'd chat and we'd get to know each other for an hour and a half every morning before going to class.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah. And I said to him very early on in that first week, I said, do you want to make movies together? Like, do you want to make like I'm talking big ones. And he was like, I'm all in. And he's produced every single one of my short films. And now, lo and behold, he produced my first feature.
So this is quite a history.
It's quite a history.
So how did Hike come about? Because that's your first big deal.
First big short film, yes.
Right. Yeah, that seems like an oxymoron, but your first big short film.
Yeah.
And you made it while you were in school?
It was my final piece of school. Yeah, my final year.
And did you ever imagine how well received it would be?
No. I mean, I knew that my idea for that was an odd concept, you know, a film that went backwards, which had been done with Memento.
What's Hike about?
Hike is about a woman who kind of finds herself falling in love with the wrong kind of guy, getting involved in drugs and other things, and she finds herself on the road. She wakes up in a pine tree forest with a big gash on her head, and she doesn't know how she got there. She's, suffering from some kind of amnesia, and she has to go backwards to figure out how she got there. And she finds out that the person she was with has been killed, and that she went on the path that she shouldn't have. And so she kind of starts the whole f she ends the film starting over again and trying to get her life back together.
But it's a short film that is a dramatic film, not a documentary.
No, dramatic, yes.
Right.
And it's and we shot on 16mm, so that was a lot of fun. And then our second film we made together, Persepio, was shot on 35mm, which was also a lot of fun.
Is that what gave you street cred, those two films?
I'd say so. And then Across the Pond, which was our third one. I think you have to make about three short films before you look, that's not a rule, but that's kind of how I saw it. I was like, I need to make three well-received short films that are quite different from each other, that show, the breadth of what I could do. And then hopefully people will believe in me and give me the support that I need and the financial backing and all that to make a feature.
So what were your roles, no pun intended, yours and Carlo? Were you the director and he was the producer?
I write, direct, and edit, and Carlo produces.
And Carlo produces. So then what prompted you to leave the land down under?
That's a good question.
Because so you're doing okay there.
I was doing okay, but I was working as a commercial editor by that point. Actually, I kind of fell in love with editing while at school. It wasn't something that I ever thought about doing. And then when we did our, this course is great, and they kind of, the first year you do a little bit of everything in the industry, and then you get to specialize after. And I kind of took the editing class not thinking much of it, then realized I was like, I really love this. It's another way of telling story. It is, the third storyteller type thing. I'm very grateful that I learned my, got my stripes there with editing. And I became an assistant editor straight out of university at a production company in Australia. And over the course of only like 18 months had to, gotten clients and become a full editor.
Are you still in a relationship with Carlo? A professional relationship with him?
Oh, yeah. But okay. Carlo has his own story, and he went off to go be a public servant for a few years. He was pretending to be a straight man for a while until he was 25. And then he was like, I'm gay. Why am I doing this? And I was the first person he told, which I'm very grateful and honored to be that. And then he kind of embraced his creative side more. So I think he was on his own journey. As young people trying to find out their path. So yeah, so commercial editing. And then I kept trying to get like more films made. And the industry in Australia is very small in terms of the film industry, and it's very competitive. And I kept finding that instead of us all being, and look, things have changed in the 8 years I've been away, I'm sure, but instead of everyone trying to support each other and lift each other up and help on each other's projects, like you do this on mine, I'll do this on yours. It just was so competitive. And it was a lot. I think this was what happens when you have a small industry where there's not enough jobs to go around. And I just was like, this is not, I don't want to compete with my friends for this one job. It just wasn't in my personality. I didn't see why we all couldn't get our films made. So I knew it was inevitable that I would move to the United States at some point, considering it's the, the land of film.
I guess as far away as the States is from Australia, just sort of based on your chutzpah and your strong sense of self, moving halfway across the world made perfect sense to you. Maybe the toughest thing might be leaving your family. I mean, look what your mom did in utero.
Yes, exactly.
The acorn doesn't fall far, right?
No, that's right. And I said that my nana and nannu, my grandparents, really struggled to understand why I would leave Australia when it's, they came here and had to sacrifice so much to get there. And I said, but it's because of that that I'm able to leave.
Exactly.
You and I are not that different. I'm still trying to chase those opportunities and those dreams of mine, just like you were doing for you and your family. So yeah, it was hard to leave my family, but I've always been an intrepid traveler, and so the distance didn't feel too far.
You came here cold, no connections, no place to live, no job.
Nothing.
The fact that you have this, genetic disposition is one thing, but that's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean,
to do that solo. So, and I know you were how old?
I was 25.
And you came where? West Coast or East Coast?
So I went to the West Coast for 6 weeks and was like, not for me.
Well, it's also closer to Australia, right?
Yes. It's only 14 hours yeah, as opposed to 24 right. or something like that. I've learned to love LA over time. And I do love it more because I have close friends there now. But at the time, going in there, not knowing anyone, I just felt like it was the most superficial place. And I was like, no, this is not the energy that I want to be around. So I only spent about 6 weeks there. And then I moved to New York, which I kind of knew in my heart I would just like, I'd never visited. And I knew I loved it. So I moved and that was it.
All alone. I mean, I'm not trying to deify you, but I think that's really stunning to come to this city. You're not the first person, I get it, yeah. but to just not have any connections.
I had a few friends.
So you had a place to crash and you had people to...
No, I actually found a place on Craigslist and luckily it turned out. I paid for 3 months in advance. So, you know, could imagine if that didn't work out. No, I didn't have a place to crash, but I no one seems to have spare rooms in this city, which I understand now. But so I moved straight into like a sublet situation.
And did you get work right away in New York?
Within the first 4 weeks, yeah. And I actually just did a commercial work because that was just what my reel was. That was just the easiest way to earn money. So I started to get commercials straight away. And
Editing.
And then I got worked on Liz Garbus's film, Love, Marilyn, and that was really it.
Did you notice here that you were in a minority as a female?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And yes. That was not a problem for you.
Look, it's a problem for everyone. But yes. I mean, I think as women, we're so resilient about handling this in certain ways. So I would definitely have clients. I've definitely had my fair share of inappropriate direct male directors and clients. But I am someone who calls it out a little bit or makes a joke about it. Mm-hmm. But makes everyone feel uncomfortable in the room enough to like know that they shouldn't
knock
do
it
this
off
again. Yeah. And that doesn't always work. And I've definitely requested not to work with certain directors in my time.
So that must have been also seminal to work with a female filmmaker, Liz Garbus. And she sought you out as an editor.
So at that time, I had to prove myself to Liz a little bit, which I understand. I took a step backwards in my career and I became an assistant editor for her. Mm-hmm. This is on her film, There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane. So I had to kind of prove myself. And then through that, and she could see what I was capable of, I got promoted to an associate editor. So basically, myself and Azeen Samari edited Love, Marilyn, which was one of Liz's books.
And talk to me about Steadfast Productions. What was the genesis of forming that company?
So Steadfast is...
a great name, by the way.
Oh, it's from a John Keats poem. That's mm-hmm. And I never knew Americans spelt it differently. So now in hindsight, 14-year-old me should have picked a different name, but or spelt it the American way, because
right.
it's very confusing. People are like, I sent you an email. I'm like, no, you sent it to the American spelling of Steadfast Productions. I should really contact those guys and be like, forward me emails. So I had this production company for a long time in Australia. It was just the name for my production company that I did all of my freelancing work out of and that I would do my short films out of and everything like that. So naturally, when I moved to the States, I was like, well, this will be my product. I'll flip it up and I'll move it over here. And so I did that. And then I was kind of a one-woman show a little bit, but was doing a lot of creative work. We would be hired to do, you know, the whole project of a lot of like branded content, and startups need, you know, really exciting media. Also, I would do a lot of charity work because that's, you know, the best stories, and you get to meet incredible people who are so inspiring. So I've traveled, you know, with the Jazz Foundation and with Alima, who's a medical organization. They actually basically were the people who cured Ebola in West Africa.
Wow.
So very important organization. So I would travel with these and film and you know, do interviews and edit their videos for them to show what the breadth of their work and how important their work is. And that was something I really loved, even though it wasn't the biggest moneymaker. It was very inspiring. So, you know, we'd get these clients. And over time, I said to Carlo, who was still living in Australia, I said, I need help with this company that I've started. Also, I'm almost ready to make a feature film. And I would be so sad if you weren't here.
And what year was that?
That was 2012.
And so he came.
So he came. He left his boyfriend. I still feel bad about that.
well, he didn't have a gun to his head. I mean, he's a grown up.
No, he's a grown up. He was working on The Great Gatsby at the time.
Wow.
Yeah, so he kind of, once that wrapped up, he came over. We started working together on these smaller projects. So, you know, you kind of, as artists, you have the money-making projects and then you have, well...
That allow you to do the really important things to you.
Exactly. So we did a lot of commercial work. We did a lot of that would like get Steadfast money to put into Across the Pond, which was one of our short films, our final short film that we did here. And then we started to use that. They're like business cards, short films. You know?
Yes, yes. It's like a sizzle reel in a sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, this is what I can do. Just imagine it uh-huh. 10 times longer.
And then back on board about Greg Louganis was a big deal for you. And that you didn't do through your company. You worked with somebody else.
So Carlo and I both worked on that film. He's an associate producer and I'm one of the editors. There's myself and Karen Sim. That was a big deal for me. I got put in touch with Sheriff Ajenek, the director, through Karen, who had been editing it and was a friend of mine. And she needed help with the edit because she had taken on board another feature as well. And this feature film had turned into much bigger than we were expecting, especially because, you know, the Russian ban on basically not allowing LGBT people to display their character in Olympics, in the Olympics. And Greg became a spokesperson for that, or against that, I should say. And also that, you know, this whole story was that America diving community had shunned Greg for 25 years because he was a gay man, had HIV, and was the first elite athlete to come out with his homosexuality and with HIV. And the community just shunned him. And as a result, America was not doing well in the diving stakes, which is unusual for America to not win gold medals and things like that. And it was arguably because Greg wasn't a part of the squad in terms of coaching or anything like that. So the film really followed him go from being shunned to being a part of the team. And then America ended up winning gold. So then, of course, gay marriage became legal. Then he got married. So I was like, this turned into a big documentary.
Yeah, really. I saw it. It was wonderful.
Thank you. So it went from this tiny story to this like quite profound character arc and this incredible story of humanity and what we lose out when we have prejudice. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about that film, is like the society loses out when we you know, oppress other people.
Absolutely.
And then that ended up, you know, being nominated for an Emmy and just incredible being on HBO. And that really gave me a lot of connections to help make The Light of the Moon.
Which is a great transition. Okay, how did that come about? How and why?
Yeah, so I've been writing. I've got several feature scripts up my sleeve, but I don't have these huge connections in the industry. You know, I'm, like you said, my chutzpah is what gets me by. So a lot of my ideas are too big for a first film. I like my sci-fi and I like, kind of big character ensembles and things like that.
Was this a seed that was germinating in you for some time?
The
storyline. I said it in the introduction, but maybe you just want to briefly.
Yeah. So it's about Bonnie, who's sexually assaulted one evening, but that all happens in the first 10 minutes of the film. And what it's really about is a woman recovering from trauma.
How timely is this? Mm-hmm. Are you freaked out by that?
It's uncanny. I mean, it's really absurd. And amazing, but it's hard to, it's like that bittersweet. It's like, well, we all knew this was going on,
exactly.
But the timing for us is, you know, impeccable. And so this idea of how rape was, it's kind of twofold. One, how rape was being depicted in other films and other TV series. And I was just overall disturbed by it. You know, some of my favorite series like Game of Thrones and things like that, just gratuitous violence against women and then not following that woman and seeing how she recovers from it, or using it as a way to make a woman more complex and interesting, or as a rape revenge fantasy, which just doesn't happen.
Well, there are not enough women who are tackling that subject. It's all men.
I know. So I just kind of sat there and was like, why are we allowing men to do this, to tell
to
our narratives?
For us. Mm-hmm.
So that was sitting in the back of my mind. And then unfortunately this happened to a friend of mine, where she was assaulted one evening on the Upper East Side while jogging. So completely, you know, broad daylight, actually, it was still summer. And then seeing, you know, what she went through and how she tackled it or didn't tackle it and tried to just push it down and deny it. And then also just all the day to day, you know, I didn't realize how extensive the evidence collection is and how invasive it is. And I didn't realize about how the chances of you finding this guy are literally like 1%. And then just trying to piece back your life, trying to have an intimate relationship with someone again. you know, how do you do that? And how do you, how you can pretend it's not affecting you, but that doesn't mean it's not. And so this woman just started to like
form
in my mind where I was like, what about a strong, complex woman who is, you know, a professional and has a great relationship, although, you know, it has some cracks in it. And how does she put her life back together? I don't want to see the crumbling victim. I don't want to, how do we as women navigate this? And I felt that that was story enough. I didn't need this courtroom drama, this revenge plot, things like that. I felt like seeing a woman navigate her relationships, her work, her friends, her family after this traumatic event that she had no reason to blame herself, but inevitably she does, as I think most women do.
That's right.
You know, I felt like that was just a story and a complex woman.
So was it easy to write? And what I mean by easy in terms of flowing from you?
Yeah, so because of my acting background, that's how I write. So I improv a lot with myself.
So you were Bonnie.
Yes, I was Bonnie and I was Matt in the same. So I record myself. I hope no one ever finds these tapes.
Is Matt her boyfriend?
Matt's her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. So I will change my voice. I will change my,
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I haven't met a writer who does it like this. So what I do is I record, like put my iPhone on and have an app on there. And I go back and forth and then I imagine these scenarios, like the first time after, you know, they've had sex, the conversation, what does that look like? And I will just do both characters until I get to a point, and it's almost like a meditation where the words start to flow out of me and they are the character and they're getting to the point of, so there's this one line where she says, did it turn you on? And she's trying to just ask that as a leeway because she knows she couldn't stop thinking about it during when they were having sex. So therefore, what does that say about her? And it's this complex, you know, thing that she's trying to tackle in her mind. And I was just like, oh, that's fascinating. Like, okay, so I'll write that line down and then I'll do another improv exercise and then something else will come out. And eventually I'll be able to piece the scene together from all of these many hours of improv. And I did a whole bunch of research with rape survivors, social workers, nurses, doctors, DAs, to make sure I was, that's my documentary background.
Well, you know, my point, yes, that this is not a fantasy.
No, I want to make sure I'm telling this.
Absolutely.
If what I'm upset about in other depictions is that it's not realistic, then how can I make this real? And how can I show what really goes on, you know, on a day-to-day basis?
How long did the film take to make from inception? Two and a half years. And now that it's out there.
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind, you know. So we premiered, like you said, at South by Southwest in March. And that was just amazing. And I should put this in context for any other creative women listening who are maybe doubting whether they have the chutzpah, whether this is an industry they should like keep pursuing or things like that. In December last year, that I was crying on the phone to my mom saying, is it too late for me to become a doctor? So I don't want people to think that I'm just...
This was a walk in the park.
Yeah, this is... I'm sure everyone listening to this knows it's not a walk in the park, but that I hadn't heard back from... South By was the first festival that we'd submitted, and I don't know why, but to hear before the end of the year is absurd for a March festival, but I just had it in my mind that they would call me the next day and be like, yes, we want your film.
Sure.
And so I was down in Australia visiting because it was my brother's wedding, and I was crying in this car with my mum in Tasmania. We'd gone camping and I was just like, what am I going to do? I've failed as this director. Like, nobody wants my film. I don't know why I was being so dramatic, but I was. And then literally the next day they called to say that they wanted
it. But I get the fact that there was a crack. I mean, even though you had tremendous street cred and you had all of this under your belt, this was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I so don't begrudge you that feeling. And I think we've all experienced that. And yeah, you're out there being judged. It's not quite so simple.
Yeah. And it's like, it's from my heart. And this is my big piece of art.
Exactly. I've just taken all my clothes off. And I don't mean to use that as an image.
No, I hear. Another judgment to me, like just kind of like what I was talking about with my acting when I was 14, 15, 16, I was like, oh, everyone's going to, you know, this is them telling me I'm not worthy or I'm not good enough. It was not the case at all, but I just...
Was it hard to get funding for the film?
Oh, 100%, 200%. We had to get funding at every month. We had to, you know, we ran out of money.
Where was the shot? All in New York?
All in New York.
Which is not cheap to do.
Not cheap. But this is where all of our connections are. So I say that there is one big film that you can ask favors for. And this was this. So I worked with all of these incredible, you know, cinematographers, Autumn Aiken, who's my cinematographer, other post-production people, And I'd developed that credibility with them that they knew that I was good for it. So I'd worked with these artists and
You had the street cred that I mentioned and a history.
So they could, asking them for a favor and asking, and I was like, look, this is what I envision for this film. So I suppose that's what I was nervous about as well, because I'd made all these promises that this film would be worth their time and worth their creative energy. And so I'm glad to say that it was. And I'm also glad to say that every single person who turned us down for funding has emailed me since to say they were wrong.
Isn't that fabulous? What just desserts. We've run out of time, but before we wrap it up, can you give us a hint as to what's in the future?
So I'm actually heading off to Toronto to do The Handmaid's Tale for two episodes of season two. I've been chosen to shadow Kari Skogland, the director, one of the directors there. So I'm very excited about that, because I've never, you know, been in TV before. And so, you know, I'm going to learn from the best and arguably the best show on TV at the moment. So I'm very excited about that. And then I am developing a very quite large budget science fiction film about an android and a human woman falling in love.
One of your first loves, right?
One of my first loves is sci-fi. And so now after this film, I have, you know, I've gotten managers and agents and all that wonderful
stuff.
They're
knocking on your door.
It's definitely
an embarrassment of riches. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
No, I mean, this is what I've been dreaming about doing, so I'm going to run with it. Yeah, and I'm excited to get out there and get my second film made.
Will you come back?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
Well, that's a deal. And that's a date.
Yeah,
okay?
Let's do it.
Jessica Thompson, thanks so much for joining me. What a fascinating conversation, and sharing your life, your work, your goals, your passions. It was a very fast conversation as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this. Thanks, Sandy.
Thank you. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.